So, a reminder that the slides from tonight, the audio recording, and the contents of the chat window will go up on the website sometime later on this evening. And with that, I'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, I just have to try and find my deal. It just, the slide stopped advancing, so I'll have to try again. Yeah.
Looks good.
Okay, welcome everyone. Full program again tonight, so we'll get right to it. And the first thing I have is a share. If anybody's interested in image file formats and doesn't really know about the difference between rasters and vectors and doesn't know about color space and alpha channels and bit depth and doesn't know the difference between a JPEG and an SVG file, this YouTube video is from Christopher Barnett. He used to be in IT and was a university lecturer, I believe, and now runs this YouTube channel and has weekly videos on things of interest. And this particular one is, as it says, is talking about image file formats. And it's actually quite interesting if you don't know about all those things. It's very basic, but it may be useful to people. So that's something to take a look at, perhaps. We have a bunch of follow-up questions, or really questions that we didn't get around to last week that people put in the chat window. And the first one was a member looking for a small form factor computer. And a 12-year-old desktop needs replacing. But the criteria are basically a small form factor. Looking at HP, Dell, Asus, Lenovo, and Intel's NUCs. Anybody have any bright ideas about a small form factor computer that would fill the bill? And I think one of the other issues here is it has to be a fairly powerful computer, not just a baby do-nothing type thing. So, if you have any thoughts on that, put something in the chat and we can revisit it later on. Second question, a different member has a problem with a HP app, which is for a scanner, which has stopped working and is looking for a replacement scanning program, preferably or definitely freeware. So again, if anybody has any bright ideas about free scanning programs, the chat window is open for your comments. Josh says IrfanView.
With IrfanView, you can in the menu there is a place where you can scan images from a scanner.
Okay, thank you. And Tom's saying that ViewScan has a free edition. So there's a couple of possibilities to look at. If anything else, put it in the chat window. Another question was, are AMOLED screens the same as OLED? And if they are not, do OLED screens also burn in? And I didn't know what an AMOLED screen was, so I looked it up. And OLED screens are basically organic light emitting diodes. So you have a thin film display of LEDs. They use organic compounds, which give you the electroluminescence and give you the nice bright colors. In an AMOLED, you have an additional layer of thin film transistors, and these act as switches for individual pixels on the screen. Now, the beauty of this technology over the old backlighting type technology is that you don't need any backlighting. And it's kind of active technology. And because the transistors can be literally on or off, you get high contrast because When it's on, you get a bright light, and when it's off, it's totally black. So you get really good contrasty displays. And they're allowed to produce very thin displays, and the gamers like them because they have very fast response times. So to get to the question, though, about OLED, OLED is the same as AMOLED in terms of it burn-in can be a problem. So here's a couple of resources that you might want to look at if you have an OLED screen. The next question was to do with flyers and cashback apps. And the question is, are there any pitfalls when you're using things like Revy and Flip, Checkout 51, Cattle, and Eclipsa? And are there any pitfalls? And how do the people that run these things make any money? So if you have the answers to those questions, you know where to put your answer. My wife told me about Flip, and as far as I can see, it's basically just points to a whole bunch of different store flyers. They're listed by category, so if you're interested, for example, tomorrow all the grocery flyers come out, and you can click on the grocery category, and then you'll get all kinds of access to all kinds of different store flyers selling groceries. As far as I can see, the site, there's no cost involved. You don't have to join or anything. There don't seem to be any adverts other than the actual store flyers themselves. So it's not ad-intensive web pages. So presumably, because they're promoting flyers from companies, presumably it's the companies who are funding the display on the web page. So it kind of gives you a one-stop shopping, I guess, for all kinds of different stores and different flyers. So if anybody knows anything different, I'm sure we can come back to that later on too. So next up.
I have another link to a flyer called flyerca.com. It's in the... it's in the chat, and they have, you may find it useful to turn off some of the things in the U-matrix, because you can get the page to display, the flyer to display as one long continuous series of pages going down rather than having to click back and forth. And I find that a much more useful format when you're looking up stuff.
Okay, thanks for that, Tom. So next up, we have our session on smart applications, and in particular, Tom. You can unmute yourself again, Tom, because you're next. So Tom has a number of apps all to do with measuring various things.
Yes, this one, Lux Light Meter Pro. If you've bought flashlights or light bulbs and seen the things where it says the number of lumens on it, and you wonder, well, what is a lumen? Well, the definition of a lumen is that it's one lux over one square meter. And this is a way of measuring lux or foot candles. It's a free app. If you're interested in light levels or comparing light levels, then you can use this to measure how bright a light is to compare them. I'm really into numbers, aren't I? So to calculate lumens for a light source, you illuminate a circle and measure, put your phone in the middle. But for a spherical source, like a light bulb that shines out in all directions, then you just hold the phone 28 centimeters away facing the light, and you'll get the number of lumens, you'll get the number of lux measured by your phone, and that way, and that's the same as the number of lumens that that light source is producing. You'll note that a lot of flashlight ads, especially. They have 10,000 lumens, but it's not true. But you can compare see how bright your flashlight is and your lights are, that way you can use that to figure out what kind of light you want send it back if it doesn't measure up. Barometer, another number thing. Needs a phone with an internal air pressure. By the way, these are all Android apps. It needs an internal air pressure sensor, a barometer inside of it. It shows the current air pressure in the history graph, can trigger alarms and sudden changes, which can be important to you, especially if you're outdoors camping. Today, congratulations. It has a widget that can sit on your home screen that shows the value and the trend. And it's a simple tracker. It tracks it over the past 3 days. It does support mean level air pressure, so you can kind of calibrate it to fit with your particular altitude. Did I say track history up to 1 week? I think it's only, the graph at least is only 3 days. Next. Now here's the example. On the left side is the widget sitting in my home screen. At 1063.2 millibars. The general trend is upwards. If it's going really fast upwards, then you'll actually see two squiggle arrows. And on the right side, at a screen, millibars is 1066, and you see the air pressure history in a graph, and you can expand and shrink the graph. You can also get a list of all the air pressure history, and I think you can save it to a CSV file on your phone and then do more things with it if that's of interest.
We have a question from Joss. Barometer, how does it measure that? If the phone has a pressure sensor, why?
The phone has a pressure sensor exactly for this purpose, for helping to determine the altitude that you're at. I think it helped. I think the GPS, some GPSs may actually use that in determining and helping determine where you are exactly. Why? Because it's. I think the main reason it's a cheap sensor and they could put it in, and so they did. Just like they put in a light sensor. That light sensor is on the front of your phone. It doesn't use the camera. It's a separate light sensor. And they use that for detecting whether it's in your pocket or where there's no light, and other uses as well. So, and there's a variety of other sensors. There's an app called Sensor Box, which can show you what sensors you have and what their values are as they're measuring it. And you can look up that on Android, and it's another free app.
One of the good things about a light sensor is that they can set it so that it changes the brightness of your screen according to the ambient light.
Yeah. And the last one is depth of field, more numbers. So you may notice that when you focus on something with your phone or your camera, that stuff before ahead of that and behind that is out of focus, it's blurry. And that's to do because lenses focus at different things at different areas, and it's blurry. If you shrink down your aperture, if you have an f1.4 lens on your camera, the depth of field, the zone which is acceptably sharp, is very narrow, and stuff on other sides is blurry. And the depth of field indicates how much stuff you can put in focus. If you have a camera, then you can actually have a hyperfocal distance, which where you get everything from infinity back to about half of the hyperfocal distance in focus. If you look on your camera, on your lens, there's usually a red line I'm getting confused here. Anyway, so you have, you can put in to this app, and there's a Windows version as well. You put in your lenses. These are things, these are scales where you move the scale on up or down with your finger. On the left side, the scale is your lens. The right side, then the aperture. Then there's the display of what's in focus and what your focus point is. You can move the distance, how far you are away from something, and you can set the amount of blur. It will tell you what the amount of blur is at that particular point, and it gives you a visual representation of that blur, where the wide line is the big blur and the yellow is a small blur. Now, small blur can be arbitrarily small, and when something is actually in exact focus, your sharpness is limited by other things, not by focus. And one of the things that can limit it is diffraction. So when you get to very small lenses, diffraction sets in really early, which is why if you check the specs of your phone is usually F2 or F1.7 or something like that, or maybe F2.2, and you can't adjust that. If you go to the Open Camera app, you can't change your aperture very much, if at all. And that's because you get it too small and everything's blurry. It becomes like a pinhole camera. Now, you've got the DOF. This app takes into account both diffraction and focus blur. And diffraction can be a major factor, which is why when you're using a camera, if you want big depth of focus, you go to F16 or F22, and everything is in focus from close to far. The hyperfocal distance for F22 on a 35mm lens is, I think, about 7 feet. So everything from about 3.5 feet to infinity is in focus. But when you go down to those small apertures, the small size aperture, which is, since F22 is the ratio between the opening on your lens to the focal length, then it can be a major factor, and you're going to lose sharpness. So that's why you're told with a camera that you're ideal sharpness is probably F5.6 or F8, because that's a balance between depth of field and also the problems at making a big fast lens. You get all kinds of aberrations of different kinds at with one that's wide open, and diffraction, which you will get with F16 and F22 on 35mm cameras. And then everything is kind of semi-sharp, rather, because the diffraction affects the sharpness of everything, not just what's at the focal plane. So you can download the reference manual, and there's a Windows version of it. You can explore things, and it's one of the things this is really good for is when you're looking at doing any macro focusing, you can change those the distance to very, very close in, and you can see how much depth of field you have and at what particular aperture. So compare the blurs. So if you're interested in photography, then this can be a great tool in a number of situations. And it will help you decide what settings you want to have with your camera.
Glenn has a question about, is there a mathematical definition of blur? And yes, there is. It's what's known as circle of confusion. And so when you're focused, there's only one point, one distance from the lens that is in sharp focus. Everything outside of that will be of something other than a point, if you are photographing a point. And so there is that circle of confusion, and there is generally accepted values for the circle of confusion, depending on a number of other factors. And I think all of the depth of field calculators that are out there start with the generally acceptable or accepted value for the circle of confusion, but most of them will allow you to modify that as well in the calculations.
Also, if you notice on lenses, they will have, at least on old camera lenses, I don't know about the newest, which they may not actually show the aperture. You may not have that choice. But where you have the choice of changing the aperture on the lens and changing the focus on the lens, you will see a series on either side that goes with apertures on it, like 2.8, 5.6, 11, 22 on one side and on the other side. And that's indicated, that's a way of setting your hyperfocal distance. You can just set infinity to be at the lens aperture you're using, and that's a hyperfocal distance that you have the focus set at. You can also use it for determining the depth of focus for particular apertures that you're choosing on your lens. How they decide what the best circle of confusion is basically they take ordinary eyesight and have an 8x10 picture at about 10 inches. And what is the circle of confusion, I think, is 1/100th of an inch. If it appears sharp, that's the circle of confusion that they use for an 8x10. Now, if you have a great big mural and you're 10 inches away from it, the depth of field needs to be the depth of field is much, much compressed because you're closer, and so the blurriness you will notice. I hope that's clear. Any questions?
We just have a couple of comments on it. There's a couple of links that people have put in for more information about things like mathematical expression for image processing, and I think that's about it.
Wikipedia is your friend.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Tom. Okay, so moving along, we're going back to the question of abandoning Windows 11. And we spent quite a long time and a number of sessions looking at different apps in Windows and how to accommodate them in either by using Linux apps or workarounds or running Windows apps in Wine, that kind of thing. The question is, what else do we need to know if we're interested in Linux at all at this stage? Now, just go back to my issue. My problem is that my brand new laptop, which is, I was amazed to find out my brand new laptop is now 7 years old. It's basically ineligible for upgrading to Windows 11. And one of the reasons is because it's a Dell Inspiron, and the Inspiron line has no TPM or PTT, the trusted platform module, the security chip that it needs. And then the second problem is, this is the Windows health check here. The second problem is that although it has a Core i7 CPU, that processor was built in 2014. And that predates the earliest CPU on the approved list, which is third quarter of 2019. So it's pretty clear that whatever Windows decides in the end, my laptop is not going to be running Windows 11. So that leaves me with the problem that Windows 10 is going to reach its end of life. And that happens in October of 2025. And once that happens, there'll be no more security patches. And so it won't be viable to keep running Windows 10. So the question is, what are the options? Well, clearly I can't just purchase Windows 11. because my CPU isn't going to be supported, so that's not going to work. I could buy a brand new computer, but that's going to cost me literally thousands of dollars. I'm not too thrilled about that, because my little steam-driven laptop here chunters away quite merrily. It's a happy little beast. I could just continue to use Windows 10, but as I said, it's not going to be secure, so that's not a viable option as far as I'm concerned. But you know that I really use Linux most of the time anyway, and I've shown in the last number of sessions that I can do most things in Linux, and there's only really one application that won't actually run in Linux. So the other question is, and this is what we've been looking at, are all the applications and alternatives that you need available on the Linux platform? And as I say, everything is except for one program. The final question here, can any Windows-only applications, which is my issue, can I run them securely in either a virtual machine or by dual booting, use Linux most of the time, and then when I want to run that one program, I dual boot into Windows 10 and have it isolated from the internet, so it's a completely locally run program and therefore secure. And then the final question you have to ask is Linux going to run on this old box of tricks? And the answer is, Linux will run on just about anything. There's going to be a distro of Linux which will run on your machine for absolutely certain. So if you're interested in, if you have all those problems and you don't want to buy a new computer, and there are issues with not being able to run everything that you wish, then how do you actually test this out? So the question is, how do you install Linux? And the first answer is, don't. Don't install Linux. What you really want to do is create a bootable disk. Typically, it's called a live USB or a live CD, a live DVD, really. If you create a bootable drive, then Linux gives you the option to try the operating system and all its built-in applications from the live USB and memory, and you don't affect your actual computer in any way whatsoever. So it's a kind of a try before you buy, and remember that buying is free anyway, so it really costs you nothing except time if you use a USB. So the steps are, you would download a Linux distro, which will come as an ISO file. You'll burn that ISO file to a USB drive. And I use USB drives because once I've tried out the distro, I can reuse the USB. Whereas if I burn the ISO to a DVD, then the DVD becomes useless if I don't like the ISO. So USBs are quite useful for this purpose. And you then have to boot Linux from the USB drive, so you have to know how your computer is going to be able to be booted from that bootable medium. And then once you've done that, then as I say, Linux is running directly from the USB and your computer's memory, the volatile memory, and all the OS and all the included applications are running on your machine. The only thing you really have to do is connect to your Wi-Fi so that you can surf the internet. Now, clearly, when you have a version of Linux running, Linux doesn't know the password to your Wi-Fi router, so you have to tell it that in order to be able to use the internet. And then, now you've had the opportunity to try everything that you want to in Linux. If everything's working, then you can consider installing Linux, and I would suggest do it in dual boot mode. So leave Windows in place and install Linux side by side by using a separate disk partition. Next question would be, which distro are you going to use? I would recommend using Linux Mint. mainly because Mint is very Windows-like. And especially if you use the Cinnamon Edition, you'll see in a minute that it looks very similar to Windows in a lot of respects. The ISO is a 2 GB download, so that tells you that you can't burn the ISO to a CD. The CD is only 700 meg or something, so it's not big enough. So you need a DVD if you're not going to use a USB. And if you use a USB, then you need something bigger than 2 gigs, or at least a 4 gig hard drive. But these days, they're really cheap and really big, so that's not a problem. To get the distro, you just go to linuxmint.com. You can download it from anywhere in the world, but there are a couple of Canadian mirrors, the Manitoba Unix Group and the Waterloo Computer Science Club are both mirrors that I've used to download the software. And then you need to burn it to the USB. I'm going to only talk about USBs now. So I would suggest using Rufus, which is a Windows program. And you really have to do two things. You have to tell it which USB drive you want to burn the thing to. And you have to browse by selecting here. You have to browse for the distro that you've just downloaded. And then once you've done that, you can leave all of these other items as at their default value and just press start. And you will end up with a bootable USB drive. So the next question is, how do you get it to boot? Well, you have to tell your computer that you want to boot first from the USB. And there are a couple of ways that you might have to do that. If you're using a BIOS type system, generally you have to access the BIOS by something like F2 or some key or other when the machine is first booting up. And you go into this BIOS settings system, look for the setup utility, the boot, and then you can change the order. You can basically tell it, go to the USB first, and then go to the hard drive if there's no bootable USB available. And in my system on the Dell Inspiron, there's actually a boot menu. So when I power the machine on, I actually hit F12, and that brings up a boot menu, and then I can just point to the USB drive, and it boots from the USB. And once the USB boots up, just be aware that it's a different boot process from Windows. Whereas Windows, you get a splash screen, and then you often get a circle going round and round forever until things happen. And in Linux, it basically displays a whole bunch of commands, and they scroll up the screen fairly quickly, but there are lots of them, and some of them say errors, but they're really, it's only for debugging if there's a real problem, and you need to know what you're doing to look at all that stuff. And generally, it just works. So just ignore all the scrolling commands and wait until the desktop loads. And once that happens, you'll see a screen something like this. So you recognize that as a Windows lookalike type screen. You've got a desktop. And if we do a quick tour of the desktop here, in the top left-hand corner there, there's a bunch of icons which are familiar to Windows users. And you notice that these are all kind of disk drive type things. When you first boot up, you get a warning message or an information message, really. And it says that Linux has booted, and it saw the Wi-Fi router, and it's just telling you if you want to use Wi-Fi, then use the network menu in order to connect to your Wi-Fi network. The network command is down here on the taskbar, and then over here on the taskbar, you've got Firefox and the start menu and the file explorer type file manager window down here. So, with our screen, what are we going to do? Well, it's really tempting to say install Linux Mint, but remember we're trying this out. We don't really want to install Linux. We're just going to use it. So basically ignore installing Linux and instead go down to the bottom right-hand corner next to the date and time setting here and click on this double arrow thing, which is the network settings menu. And when you pop up that, then you'll get and you can click on network settings. And when you do that, you'll get a list of the Wi-Fi systems that it can see. And it can see here three different systems. I'm interested in this one here called Duck Pond. So I click on this settings icon, and it brings up the second window where I can choose security, which brings up this final window where I can enter the password for my wireless access. So now I have access to the internet. So now the next thing to do is go to the Windows Start menu, the Linux Start menu down here at the bottom. And when you click on this Start menu, then it pops up this, this is kind of a Windows 7-like menu where you get a whole bunch of categories. So you've got graphics programs and internet programs and sound and video. And I've highlighted the Office applications here. And now you can see these are the pre-installed packages which are available when you install the Linux distro, and you're getting LibreOffice Writer, which is like Microsoft Word. You're getting Calc, which is like Excel, and you're getting Impress, which is like PowerPoint. And so you can play around with these menus and these different apps, and you can check out Linux in this live distro type version, and you haven't actually affected your computer at all. So it's a really neat option to try all of the features of Linux on your hardware. So you'll know whether Linux is going to A, work on your machine, and B, whether it gives you the features and the power that you need. And we've seen in some of the earlier situations where it's very easy to use this icon up here, for example, the software manager, to go and search for other applications and install them directly in addition to all the stuff that is built in. So if you're interested in Linux at all, I highly recommend, in fact, that you try out a Linux distro using a live USB. That's it for Linux for now. So now let's move along, and I hope Bob Walker has joined us.
Yeah, he is here. But just before we do that, I'll just point out that in our initial questions, there are some things in the chat window about small form factor computers. There's some information about scanning apps, and there's some information in there about flyers and cashback apps as well. So if anybody's interested in the answers to those, check out the chat. We may have time later on to come back and discuss them a little bit more. But we'll now pass it over to Bob.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay, so let me get to sharing the screen here. Okay. Oh, error message there. Okay. Can you see me full screen now?
Yep.
Okay. So in this mini-series on privacy on the Internet, today is part four, some of the ways you can be tracked. Last session, we looked at private search engines, and so this week we'll do the how you can be tracked. And like the other sessions, I'll be covering this just the tip of the iceberg and pointing you towards where you can go for more information. First of all, who's tracking you? Many companies, including internet giants Google and Facebook, make most of their money by using your personal information for targeting advertising or by selling your personal information to advertisers, insurance companies, and others. Other internet giants like Amazon or from Amazon giants down to maandpa.com and everything in between also make some of their money selling your personal information, and they also use your personal information. Google trackers are present in 82% of web traffic. So you don't actually have to be on a Google site to get tracked by Google. 25% of the web has a hidden Facebook tracking pixel. So Facebook knows a lot more about what you do than just what you do on Facebook. Google's own domains don't contain that many trackers, and the same is true for Facebook. But that's because they place their trackers on many other websites. A third of the top 6,000 websites have more than 10 trackers per page. And we'll get into this in just a minute. Organizations tracking you include advertising and marketing companies, web analytics companies, political parties, and news organizations. And it also includes companies like Amazon, Yahoo, Google, AppNexus, SpotX, Quantcast, and DoubleClick. There's a great story in the New York Times titled, I Visited 47 Sites, Hundreds of Trackers Followed Me. And this story shows that everything you do online is tracked and logged in exquisite details. So you actually have no privacy. And at the bottom of the page there, there's the URL to read the story. The New York Times used a special software package from Mozilla, who are the people that do Firefox. And a reporter was able to track the trackers over several days as he carried out his normal internet activities. The diagram on the left shows the tracker's activity in just one session as he researched the story online over a couple hours. Each small dot in the circle represents one tracking resource, like a script or a tracking pixel or an image. They were able to see every site and page he visited, what clicks he made, what searches he made, and they're even able to get some of his usernames and passwords. He didn't have to visit any shady sites or make any untoward searches. He just had to venture somewhere, anywhere on the internet, and he was watched. And this is happening every day, all the time, to any of us. So how are they tracking you? There's a whole list here. We'll go through them one at a time, so I'm not going to read the list off. But the first one is cookies. When a user visits a website for the first time, the web server may generate a unique identifier or a cookie and store it on the user's browser or local space. And just to keep note, more than one cookie may be placed on the user's device during a session. There could be several cookies. The website can read and identify the user in their future visits with the stored identifiers, and the website can save your login information, language selections, user preferences, internal site bookmarks. They can keep track of your shopping cart and all sorts of other things. Now, due to privacy concerns, all the major browsers use mechanisms for deleting or refusing cookies from websites. There are different types of cookies. The first one we're going to look at is persistent cookies. And these are part of a group known as first-party cookies, or authentication cookies, or permanent cookies, or stored cookies. They work by tracking your online preferences. The security of a persistent cookie depends on the security of the issuing website and the user's web browser, and whether the cookie data is encrypted or not. There are security vulnerabilities that may allow a cookie's data to be read by an attacker and used to gain access to the user's data or to gain access to the user's with the user's credentials to a website to which the cookie belongs. And this is known as cross-site scripting or cross-site request forgery. And this is a security concern more than a privacy concern, but session cookies are temporary cookies that memorize your online activities in a particular session. Websites have no sense of memory, so without these cookies, your site browsing history would always be blank. In fact, every click you would make, the website would treat you as a completely new visitor. A good example of how session cookies are helpful is online shopping. When you're shopping online, you can check out at any time. And that's because the session cookies has been tracking your movement. And without these cookies, whenever you go to check out, your cart would be empty. Normally, session cookies expire as soon as you close out of a website. But some websites may have the session cookie stick around for the next session. For example, if you fill up your shopping cart in the session, but don't go to checkout, next time you log on to that site, it'll remind you that, hey, you got some stuff here in your cart. What are you going to do about it? Tracking cookies are commonly used as a way to compile long-term records of an individual browsing histories. And they're a major privacy concern. So two categories of cookie are one is a first-party cookie, and this includes persistent and session cookies, and these come from the site, the website that you're on. A first-party cookie can also be a tracking cookie so that the website can track your other internet activity. Third-party cookies come from a different website than the one you're on, and are almost always tracking cookies designed to track your internet activity across other websites. And so most browsers have a setting where you can block third-party cookies. And you should have this setting on your browser. Now, in most browsers, there's a private mode, and sometimes this is known as incognito mode or in private mode. When you're in this mode, it doesn't share cookies with the regular browsing mode, and it doesn't save cookies once you close it. But you want to make sure that your browser settings are set to this just to be sure. In most browsers, you can set the browser to delete all cookies at the end of a session. But if you go to particular websites on a regular basis, you can usually also have it set to leave the cookies from those websites alone when you log out. You can search on how to clear and manage cookies for the particular browsers you use. And a good place to start is this article on how to clear cookies in Chrome, Firefox, Safari, and other browsers. And there's the URL for it there. Now, there are several companies that offer tools for clearing browser cookies and caches. And these tools are often part of a more general maintenance or security package. But you want to use these tools with caution and pay attention to the settings for the tool. Because some of these tools want to mess with your registry or nominally update your drivers. And you really got to be cautious about doing this. As we've covered in past sessions on security and maintenance and everything else, some of these tools mess you up your registry more than they fix it. Examples of some of these tools are Avast Cleanup or System Mechanic. We're going to talk a little bit about bad cookies here. The terms zombie cookie, ever cookie, and super cookie, these are often used interchangeably, but they're all slightly different. But in researching all this, every website or story I went to seemed to have a different idea of what each of these are and how they work and what they do. So any information I'm using here, I basically got off Wikipedia. The names zombie cookie, ever cookie, and super cookie are a bit misleading because they're not actually cookies. A zombie cookie is a code that's been placed by a web server when the user visits a website, and on the other user's computer or on any other device like a smartphone or a tablet, the zombie cookie is hidden in a location outside the visitor's web browser's dedicated cookie storage location. And there's about 20 odd locations on the computer that they can use to store these. And when you delete the regular cookie, the zombie cookie will automatically recreate it after the original cookie has been deleted. So you can never seem to delete these, which is why they're called a zombie cookie. You can't kill them. The zombie cookie's data and code may be stored online or directly on your device. And this is a breach of browser security. This makes zombie cookies very difficult to remove. They don't rely on normal cookie protocols, and the visitor's web browser may continue to recreate deleted cookies even though the user has opted not to receive any more new cookies. Zombie cookies are also used to remember unique IDs used for logging into websites. This means for a user that deletes all their cookies regularly, a site using this would still be able to personalize to that specific user. Another type of cookies are super cookies or sometimes called ever cookies. They don't use local storage as regular cookies do. Instead, they are injected at the network level as unique identifier headers. The super cookies are inserted by your internet service provider rather than by the website itself. And you may not be aware of their existence because the ISPs generally don't advertise them. The UIDH personal data can be revealed to any website and potentially sold to third parties. The super cookies allow third parties to track you as well. They can independently identify tracking headers themselves and use the data to serve you targeted ads across the web. Like zombie cookies, they can restore the data of your deleted cookies, and they can link the data to new cookies. They can access your login credentials, image, and file caches, and plug in data. Ad blockers can't block them. And you can't clear them by deleting your browser history and cache data. You simply can't delete super cookies or zombie cookies. So what can you do about them? The super cookies depend on your HTTP connections. So making an encrypted connection with a website stops the tracking headers from functioning. So if you visit only HTTPS sites or secure websites, that use certificates, you should be able to avoid super cookies tracking you or catching a super cookie in the first place. You can also use a VPN or a virtual private network, preferably one with multi-hop and or split tunneling. And we covered this a few sessions back when I looked at VPNs. The encrypted link between your computer and the VPN server short circuits the ability of the super cookie to see and track what you're doing. Another way that they can track you is through your internet protocol address or your IP address. This is the address given to your device by your network or your internet service provider, and it can reveal your general location and some of the other information about you. Some privacy browsers can spoof or disguise your IP address, and if you're using a VPN, it usually gives you a new IP address normally on each session on a session-by-session basis. The new IP address doesn't give your general location. It gives the location of the VPN server. So if you're VPNing through a server in San Francisco, they think you're in San Francisco somewhere. Another way of tracking is through web beacons, and these are otherwise known as tags or tracking pixels. And this is pixel in a different context than the pixels as each little element of your screen. A web beacon is a technique used on web pages and email to unobtrusively or invisibly allow checking that a user has accessed some content. These are typically used by third parties to monitor the activities of users at a website for the purpose of web analytics or page tagging. They can also be used for email tracking through programs like MailTrack. Using beacons, companies and organizations can track the online behavior of the web users. The companies that were first doing this were mainly advertisers or web analytics companies. Later, the social media sites, especially Facebook, really latched onto this and went big time with it. Some specific email-specific web beacons can be blocked by browser extensions like PixelBlock, and you can search on these to find others. Email-specific web beacons can be defeated by deactivating the auto-loading for embedded images in your emails, because these beacons are usually loaded as part of the images. We'll be looking at anti-tracking tools that can also work on this in a future session. The really big one that's quite popular now is what's called fingerprinting. A fingerprint is a number that is calculated from the information about your computer, and some of it you may think is private, but through your web browser, they can find out a lot of information, including the make and model of your device, and all this other information in the list here. And by taking all of this information from the browser, they can get this from the browser, and not don't have to access the operating system at all. The fingerprint takes all of this data, turns into a number, sums it up, and then runs a calculation over it to yield a single value. This is called hashing. As long as you're using the same device and browser, every time you visit a website that uses fingerprinting, that website knows who you are and doesn't require any cookies to do this. A while ago, I sort of got the creepies. Normally, when I paid for something with PayPal, I would have to log in with the PayPal password. And a while ago, it started saying, oh, we recognize you on this particular machine. You don't have to log in. We'll complete the transaction. It's like, and I've gotten the same thing through a few other sites as well. This diagram also shows in a diagram fashion some of the ways that the fingerprinting uses the metrics. Now, ad blockers, VPNs, or using the Tor network does not make you safe from fingerprinting, because none of these options change your screen resolution, browser version, etc. So they don't change your fingerprint. The Brave browser, which is one of the privacy browsers we covered last session, has advanced fingerprinting protections that randomize the output of semi-identifying browser features and turns off features commonly used to sniff the device info. Firefox and the Tor browser also offer some protection against fingerprinting. And if you look at the session we had on privacy on the internet, part two, browsers and basic browser privacy settings, there's a bit more information on this. Another way that you can be tracked is what's called extended URLs. If you notice up in the URL bar on your browser, some URLs have extra info appended that identifies you specifically when you use the URL. Here's an example from an Ottawa Citizen story. It was actually a recipe, and at the end of the part of the URL that covers what the actual story is, there's a bunch of gobbledygook. And I've actually changed the gobbledygook in that URL so it doesn't work. So if you copy and paste this into your browser there, it won't work. But this is a crude technique that some browsers use to attack returning users and to link you to others you may have passed the URL on to. These are used quite a bit by recipe websites, so they can keep track of you if you return to their site as a regular user, and they can also track who you've passed copies of the recipe onto if you include the URL. Sometimes, and not all the time, you can delete the extra gobbledygook at the end of the URL and still get to the intended website without being tracked. Some of the above tracking techniques were originally developed or adopted by the intelligence community, particularly the National Security Agency down in the U.S. In this session, I've covered the well-known tracking techniques, but because of good folks like the NSA and other intelligence agencies and other companies who are looking to track you, there's doubtless others that we don't know about. And one of the things that you see on TV or in the movies, how the good guys can track you across the internet from node to node to node. You may think that's just the movies or TV, but it's actually true. Got some URLs here for some extra reading and some more reading. So if you download a copy of this presentation, there's a whole bunch of stuff here. I was going to try and paste these into the chat, but I didn't have time to do that after I finished getting the presentation ready. So there we go. So in this session, we've looked at some of the ways you can be tracked. The next session, part five, we'll look at anti-tracking and ad blocking software. And that's it for now. So I'll stop the share. Okay. Anything come up in the chat there, Chris?
There was just a couple of comments. I think super cookies would be illegal in Canada. One comment on first party cookies versus third party, but you covered that later on. Natalie says, I often see extended URLs and links within newsletters. I delete the extra info, especially if I'm passing on the info. Never had a problem accessing the site by doing this. I've noticed that as well. And I think they just want to see, who is actually on their mailing list is actually going to the links, how much volume you're getting out of it. I have a couple of comments on great information. And great
scary information.
And scary information.
Yeah. One of the things is, too, the comment there on something being illegal in Canada, keep in mind that an awful lot of the websites you may be visiting aren't based in Canada, so they don't really care that much. As far as legislated privacy goes, the European Union is ahead of most anybody else on this. But even they don't go anywhere near far enough. But the European Union as a whole has enough clout to enforce some of their privacy rules on any sites that target the European Union residents. On the other hand, Canada's and the United States privacy legislation is pretty weak. And we keep hearing some noises from the government in Canada here about beefing up the privacy legislation, but I haven't seen any action. So,
yeah, that seems to be it for comments in the chat.
And it also, we're also right on a few minutes over time, I guess. So, if anybody has any questions or wants to share things like Bob does, then we'll have a email address in just a second. One of these days I'll have time to talk about a special membership offer, but Chris put some information in the chat window about it. If you're not a member of OPCUG or you are a member but you know friends or relatives who would like to join, we do have a special offer right now up until March 31st. If anybody who joins for the regular price of $20 per year, it will actually get a second year absolutely free. So it's a 2-for-1 type membership offer. And as I said, if you have any questions or things that you would like to share next week, send us a heads up to this email address. And our next session will be next Wednesday, February the 2nd. So I'm looking forward to seeing everyone there. So thanks for attending tonight, and hopefully we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.